KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center. While cinema provides entertainment and escape, for many filmmakers and viewers, it is a vital portal into the lives of others, a medium of engagement, and a powerful tool for social action. Films will be shown from Thursday, October 6th through Wednesday, November 9th, and include the films Familia, Sing Your Song, An African Election, Windfall, and more. Again, that's Voices in Action, Human Rights on Film, presented by the Northwest Film Center, located at the Witzel Auditorium, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue in Portland. More information about the films can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to announce the opening of Convergence, an audio documentary and sonic artwork by our artist-in-residence, Tessie Word. The opening will be Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. Convergence examines the historical, environmental, and sociological ramifications of living in an imminent ecological disaster area, the tsunami zones of the Oregon coast near the mouth of the Columbia River. Through the use of phonographic recordings, radio transmissions, and original music, Convergence explores and interprets the cultural implications and the psychic terrain of daily life in the tsunami zone. Again, that's Convergence by KBOO Artist-in-Residence Tessie Word, opening Friday, November 14th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. at Civilian Studios, 2210 North Lewis Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And this is KBOO Portland. That's right. Coming up, it's 9:03 a.m. Coming up on APA Compass is a forum for dialogue, exploration, and dissemination of issues pertinent to the APA communities in the Pacific Northwest and elsewhere. Coming up at 10, Air Cascadia is off. We go straight to Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. Followed at 11 with Startup City, a continuing series on technology and the tech industry in the Pacific Northwest. And also on the radio zine, Kristen Yount hosts Walter Waterworld, a pilot program about policy and threats to our water system. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for community radio. For those who missed our recent membership drive, you are still able to become a member right now if you wish, anytime, at kboo.fm. Just click where it says Donate Today.
Good morning. You're listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. I'm Sari Gametha. Today, I will speak with Michael Bacon, Kim Lee, and Joseph Santos Lyons about the first ever Vietnamese dual language program in Portland Public Schools. We also have an angry APA minute with Deepa Iyer. And I'll also talk to KBOO's very own Peabody Award-winning radio documentarian, Dime Roberts. But first, Luann Algoso talks to Asa Jackson, soloist of the performance Macho Dancer.
Also, and you're listening to APA Compass. Today, I speak with performance artist Asa Jackson. Asa is featured at this year's Time-Based Art Festival, presented by the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art. Asa is from the Philippines, and the TPA Fest will be her second performance in the U.S. She will be performing two pieces at this year's festival titled Death of the Pole Dancer and Macho Dancer. I spoke to her a few days before her performance to talk about what drew her to these particular forms of dance, how her audiences have received her work, and what we can look forward to at this weekend's TBA Fest performance. For people that are new or unfamiliar with your work, can you talk us through how you became interested in macho dancing and pole dancing, and what drew you to these particular forms of dance?
So I got into pole dancing when I was in college. It was my aunt actually invited me to take a pole dancing classes. And during that time, it was one of the first batches of women taking pole dancing. It was very new to the Philippines. And I thought, let's try something new. It didn't have any kind of baggage for me that I associated it with. I mean, it didn't really matter to me. So, that was my entry point. And then at a certain point, I started teaching. And then to the point where I actually became co-director of the school. And then, during this period, especially in the beginning, I had a lot of strange questions and propositions from friends and people about the fact that I'm doing pole dancing. So they still referred to the strip dancing. So they had a very stereotypical perspective of what is happening on the pole. And I was very struck with this shift that was happening, this appropriation of the fitness industry from the strip club, and the shift in how women in general from different social strata would use this movement vocabulary. And it was interesting the tension that is built between these women who were trying out something new, and then the general public who still has this notion of pole dancing associated with the strip club. So somehow, that was quite an interesting tension for me, like this people shifting a body practice into a different space, a different, in a way, awareness, and then the general public not knowing this. So. Kind of the normal way of thinking about things was still quite behind. And then with macho dancing, it came like way after pole dancing, in a sense that it's actually a reaction to my pole dance practice, because I had the feeling that I was being associated too much with the pole, with the pole image, and that I felt that people were seeing me only in this light, that I'm a pole dancing artist somehow. And I thought that I was being limited by my own medium. Like, I'm being encased in that. Well, this fascination with macho dancing was already exist, but it was during a conversation with another artist friend. I was showing the material to him, and he said, "Wow, this is something that I've never seen before." I'm like, "What? Really? I thought all strippers around the world dance like this." And he was like, no. I mean, they have a different sense of time and things like this. And I'm like, okay. And I got more interested in it, and then I thought, okay, so maybe my next project is this macho dancing. So what would how would it be if a woman started to learn this vocabulary? So I came in, I came to macho dancing from that perspective, like really to challenge myself in terms of shifting my own body politics. Like how do I unlearn pole dancing, and how do I learn a new vocabulary? And it was really an unlearning process, because with pole dancing, like weight dynamics and posture and gaze and like the structure of your body is completely reliant on the pole. So you're basically a tripod. You have three legs. The third one is a pole. And with macho dancing, it's completely the opposite. You have this very connected relationship with the ground. Almost like you have this relationship with the ground, so you're very stable and grounded. This was tremendously difficult for me to shift to dance without the pole.
In what ways are these forms of dance in conversation with being Filipina? Are they challenging Filipina identity or informing it, and how so?
The Filipino identity in general, or identity in general, is a bit of an illusion that we all kind of fall back on, so that we kind of categorize a group of people so we know who they are and know how to position ourselves from them. And in that sense, that's the use of identity somehow. So I think the works that I do in relation to, let's say, the general stereotype of identity of Filipino, Filipina, would challenge this identity, in a sense that it's not the typical representation of a Filipino body, especially in cultural platforms, even in contemporary platforms. I don't think it is being tackled in such a way. Well, it was interesting when my father learned about my new project, the Macho Dancing, when it was still being proposed. He was was completely shocked. He was like, why can't you do some folk dancing, you know, like to represent the pride of the Filipino people? But I'm like, but that's what I'm doing. It's like folk dancing, but in the urban landscape, in a sense that it's contemporary social practice. Mm-hmm. And you know, folk dance is located in a community. It has a specific social function. Mm-hmm. And in that way, macho dancing has that function. Mm-hmm. In Manila or in urban scapes in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Just to answer the question in a very simple way, it's there to challenge this identity. Mm-hmm. To give a different perspective or another dimension. Mm-hmm. Just to say that this Filipino identity isn't so fixed.
Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. That actually leads me into the next question of how has the Filipino community responded to your pieces? Do their reactions differ to American audiences or even Filipino-American audiences? And can you expand on that?
The piece actually was premiered in Europe. Mm-hmm. Was made, produced, and traveled first more in Europe actually than in America or the Philippines. Mm-hmm. It only premiered in Manila in July, this July. Oh, okay. So it has kind of matured and grown 2 years before it was actually shown. Mm-hmm. The full piece in Manila. And it was more difficult to show it there, in a sense that I had the feeling, or I had the impression, that I had to create the framework for it to exist. If I didn't, then it could be read in so many ways. It's a very fragile work. Mm-hmm. And I thought that it needs a strong structure to support it. Mm-hmm. And so what I did is early January, no, February, I had a solo exhibition in the University of the Philippines, mm-hmm. Diliman. There's a gallery there. Mm-hmm. So it was a exhibition that came out of the research and the process of macho dancing. So the title of the exhibition was Philippine Macho Academy, PMA. And it was in reference to the Philippine Military Academy in the Philippines. So it's kind of referring to this institutionalized machismo. Mm. But of course, it's a play on the irony of an institution and an institution forming bodies. You know, like training and in the sense of Philippine Military Academy training, like the soldiers and the, you know, a certain maleness. Mm-hmm. That is standard of a nation, and
PMA, Philippine Macho Academy, is kind of the maleness in an economic network sense. So it's two institutions trying to do the same thing, but for different social functions. And within that exhibition, there is this handbook. It's like a fitness manual in a way that the vocabulary is broken down, like how to stand, like how to get into the position, macho position, and the waves and the knees. So it's kind of a syllabus of a step-by-step how to be a macho dancer in a fitness manual sense. So there was that, and then there was also classes with the dance department. So we did an intervention which they were showing the actual class. Mm-hmm. So, and then of course there were kind of body maps as well of like breaking down the physical principles of macho dancing in different levels. Like you have this, it's inspired with this yoga positions. Mm. I kind of like copied it, but you have the macho positions. So it, in a way you kind of institutionalize, legitimize the form. But at the same time, of course, if you institutionalize something, then it's there to be attacked, it's there to be problematized, it's there to be you basically put it in a scientific table as opposed to just having it exist outside the, let's say, the academic zone. So in that sense, that paved the way for the actual, I mean, there was a small kind of excerpt showing, but it wasn't the full show because they didn't have the right equipment for an actual show. And it was an exhibition space, a gallery space. So the audience viewing is quite different from a theater viewing, theater sense. But that paved the way for the actual performance. A contemporary dance festival invited it, the only contemporary dance festival in the Philippines. But at the same time, I got a lot of critique with the work. Because of course, I don't think this kind of subject is easily dealt with in the art world in any case. And so certain stereotypical criticism just arise. And it's there. But at the same time, there's more, what do you call this? Visibility of the work. And it was well appreciated by many, like different nodes of artistic practice, from dance to visual arts. Well, basically the two of those, dance and visual arts. Mm-hmm. So it was a good mix of people from this fields. Mm-hmm. It was very well received there, but I think it was very well received there because of the foundations that have been already placed prior to the actual showing, and the fact that it has been touring internationally. Mm-hmm. Kind of there's this buffer of acknowledgement from the outside as well. I think it would be more difficult without that to show it in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. So in terms of America, the first time that it premiered, it was in New York in Queer Festival. Mm-hmm. I think November 2013, and it was very well received there. I mean, it was a open, people were open, and it's a queer festival, so somehow it is already framed in that structure. Mm-hmm. And it's seen with other works that have a similar kind of proposition of queerness. Mm-hmm. So the work is seen in a queer, I guess, dialogue. Mm-hmm. And here I'm not sure how people would take it. I mean, it's quite interesting because of the scene. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very exciting. I think I would really like to have audiences that are actually performers as well from here. Mm-hmm. Like just to get their feedback and somehow to connect.
Thank you again to the Portland Institute for Contemporary Art for making the interview happen. And thank you to Issa Jackson for making time to chat with me about her work. For more information about Issa, check out her website at isajoxson.wordpress.com. That's E-I-S-A-J-O-C-S-O-N, Issa Joxson. This is Luann Algoso for APA Compass.
We are experiencing some slight technical difficulties. Stay tuned. We will be right with you for APA Compass. This is Angry APA Minute coming right up on APA Compass.
This is Deepa Iyer, and this is my Angry APA Minute. Have you, like me, been outraged about what has been happening in Ferguson, Missouri? This past August, many of us were gripped by the images that we saw coming out of Ferguson. Tear gas blanketing suburban streets, law enforcement creating a war zone, and defiant protesters seeking justice for the murder of Mike Brown, a young black man killed by a white police officer named Darren Wilson. Why should Asian Americans care about Ferguson, or about police brutality, or about the ways in which racial injustice plays out on the streets, in the courts, and in policies and laws? For me, the answer is simple. As communities of color, Ferguson must be and is our fight too. After all, Asian Americans are no strangers to discrimination in this country. Early Asian immigrants were run out of towns where they worked, not allowed to own property, and excluded from citizenship. Regardless of any educational or economic privilege that Asian Americans might believe that we possess, we continue to hear about workplace bias, profiling, and being perceived as forever foreigners or disloyal terrorists. Asian Americans have not been immune to police violence and discriminatory profiling by law enforcement either. Let's remember Fong Lee, the 19-year-old son of Laotian refugees, who was shot and killed in Minneapolis in 2006 by a police officer as he was riding his bike home from school. Let's not forget that since September 11, 2001, South Asians and Muslims have experienced routine and ongoing surveillance in mosques and student associations, all in the name of national security. Police brutality is just one symptom of this country's larger structural racism, which segregates our schools and cities, increases poverty and unemployment rates for people of color, and has psychological consequences for families and young people. And while African Americans disproportionately bear the brunt of the structural racism, it affects many immigrants and other minorities too, including Asian Americans. We can only end racial injustice through strategic multiracial alliances that are informed by an understanding of our connected histories and common goals. We can only end racial injustice by working within our constituencies, including Asian American communities, to address anti-Black racism and stereotypes about one another. A few weeks ago, I traveled to Ferguson to join a group of South Asians, Muslims, Arabs, and Asian Americans for the National Weekend of Resistance. We were there to stand in solidarity, to learn and listen, and to lift up the central message that Black lives matter. As we marched through the streets of St. Louis, joined protesters at the Ferguson Police Department, and talked to Asian and Arab small business owners, it became even clearer to me that Asian Americans cannot sit out the struggle for justice in Ferguson and that has spread around the country. So if you, like me, have been outraged by what you've seen and heard, then I urge you to stay angry and to use that sense of outrage. If you're a student, hold discussions on your campus that bring students of color together to talk about Ferguson and to build new alliances. Join events held by groups like Hands Up United and Millennial Activists United around the country to raise your voice against police brutality. Talk to family members and friends about what's happening in Ferguson, and don't be afraid to have those hard conversations that reveal internal biases and reactions. If your organization endorses policy statements to make changes in policing and in police departments organized by groups like Color of Change, and learn about what's happening in Ferguson directly from organizers there by plugging into Ferguson Fireside Chats, the Ferguson e-newsletter, Ferguson Friday discussions on social media, and the Ferguson syllabus. When I was in Ferguson a few weeks ago, I heard young African-American organizers lift up a powerful message from revolutionary and activist Asatha Shakur to remind us all of our duty and responsibility to end racial injustice. The message goes, "It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win. We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains." The moment in Ferguson is sparking a movement against racial injustice around the country. Asian Americans can and must and are part of it. It is our duty too.
This is APA Compass on KBOO. We're going to try once more to bring our live panel on the air. Sarika?
And we're back. Thanks again for supporting APA Compass. I'm Sarika Mehta. This year, Portland Public Schools instituted its first ever Vietnamese dual language program. While there are many bilingual ed programs around the nation, there are few which provide dual language curricula and support in Vietnamese and English. That is the topic of our discussion today, and we have some guests in studio to join in the conversation. We have Michael Bacon, Assistant Director of Dual Language Programs for Portland Public Schools. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
We have Kim Lay, an immigration lawyer and a parent whose daughter is in the program here in Portland Public Schools. Welcome, Kim.
Thank you.
And we have Joseph Santos Lyons, the executive director of the Asian Pacific American Network of Oregon, or APANO. And he's also joining us in studio today. Hi, Joseph.
Good morning.
Good morning. First, let's start with a little bit of the backstory for the Vietnamese dual language program. Maybe, Joseph, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. So in the 70s and 80s, Oregon experienced a real growth in the Vietnamese American community as a result of the end of the war on Vietnam that the Americans perpetrated. And the demographics grew considerably. Over the last 30 years, the community has grown to over 25,000 folks in the region, primarily centered around Portland. And despite years of growth and contributions to our communities, the students and the education outcomes have often been a struggle in the community. And there have been persistent inequalities, including poor academic achievement and outcomes. About a decade ago, the school district in APANO and other communities who have English language learners came together and looked more deeply at the opportunities that a dual language program could offer. And they recommended a series of expansion efforts, including the goal of creating Oregon's first Vietnamese dual language immersion program. So after many years of advocacy, we're really pleased to see Portland Public Schools in Oregon have the first dual language program based at Roseway Heights.
Excellent. And Michael, how are students chosen for this program? Is it a lottery? Do first pick go to Vietnamese families? Talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So the Vietnamese Dual Language Immersion Program is what we call a two-way immersion program. So we really target, there's two buckets, so to speak, and half those, or one bucket is for our students whose first language is Vietnamese, and the other bucket is for English speakers. They can be bilingual children, of course. And so we reserve half those slots, and they are, it does go through a process of a lottery. They put their names, and there's really no priorities other than they are, whether their first language is Vietnamese or English. So it's an open process.
So there aren't any students, for example, who would speak another language at home, not Vietnamese or English, who are in this program? I'm just curious.
Absolutely. It's an open program. So we have many of our dual language immersion programs where we have kids who are learning English and the part, what we call the partner language, as their second and third languages.
Great. And Kim, as a parent who is involved, first tell us how you learned about the program.
I first heard about the program, literally, I got a postcard in the mail. I don't know how they got my information, but it advertised that there was a new, very first year kindergarten dual language immersion program. I had no idea what that meant, so I sent an email to Kim Nguyen, who I guess coordinates the program, and I was amazed. Within a few days, I had the chance to meet with Kim and both of the kindergarten teachers that would be teaching my daughter, so that I was able to kind of rest assured in terms of the curriculum, what was being taught, and have a better understanding of what the program would provide for my daughter.
I imagine you didn't go through any such program when you were growing up.
No, I wish I had the opportunity to. I grew up in Northern California, and everything was very centered around how far could you get, like what kind of honors programs, AP programs. I went through the IB program. It was very centered around kind of academic SATs, things like that. But as I grew and became older, I realized that language is one aspect of the educational process that stays with you throughout your entire life. It is one skill that you will be able to use again and again and again. And so it became really important to us that Lynn, my daughter, already speaks Vietnamese at home. Vietnamese was her first language. I felt like it would be such a waste to kind of just ignore or put that aside in favor of maybe getting a few extra points on the SAT, things like that. So that's one of the reasons why we really looked into this program.
That's great. And so your daughter is in kindergarten, which is the first class, the inaugural class of the Vietnamese dual language program. Have you seen, it's only, you know, we're only in the first term, but have you seen any changes in her academic or social emotional growth?
Yes, definitely. Well, first of all, as I said earlier, she only spoke Vietnamese before, very limited vocabulary in English. It's been about almost 2 months since school started. She has now gone through very quickly the English vocabulary, and starting this week is beginning first grade vocabulary as well, and spelling. And she's been spelling perfectly, getting 100%, so we're very proud of her on that. But it's just amazing that she went from literally just knowing A, B, C, D, you know, very few words, to now being able to spell very well, feeling comfortable in both languages, and feeling like she has support from both communities. It's not that she's necessarily only looking for the Vietnamese teacher anymore or the Vietnamese friends. Now she feels comfortable, I'd like to imagine culturally competent in both.
That's really exciting. And that story is one story. Maybe, Michael, can you speak a little bit about how her story is supported by research for many, many students around the nation?
Sure.
For language support is what I'm getting at.
Right. So I think what's really interesting is that from a logical standpoint, you would think especially for our English language learners, what we call emerging bilingual children, that learning more in English or all their time in English, time on task, that there would be better linguistic results and better academic results when the testing's all done in English and the curriculum and so forth. That's the sort of dominant culture and curriculum that we have. However, what research, and this is not just short-term, this is long-term research over 40-plus years, that shows that actually when children learn bilingually, and actually for our emerging bilingual children, when they spend half their day or more, they actually have better, higher academic results. In fact, it really closes the achievement gap and goes beyond for a lot of our children. And they also are bilingual and biliterate. And the connections that means for the child with their family in terms of their identity that they develop, as well as all the things, you know, economic benefits and the things that Kim referred to.
Right. How has the community, both the Vietnamese community of Portland and the whole city, you know, the metro area of Portland, how have they received the news of this program? Has it been received well? Was there any resistance? Mike Lurch, does anyone want to?
Well, I can say just, you know, from the process to actually get the district to adopt the program and to fund the program, APANO worked closely with the Vietnamese Community of Oregon, which is a community-based organization that serves one cross-section of the community, and many educators who are also Vietnamese participated in a collaborative design process that Michael and the district helped to convene in the year before the program. And I would say that we had a lot of support. We had parents and we had elders. We had teachers and advocates coming together and meeting with the district and the district board and really pushing to make sure the program got started and got started this year. And we were really pleased both with the results, but also with the process that we were able to go through.
Might I add just a piece to that? I would say probably in working in dual language immersion over 19 years, this has probably been the most collaborative process with our community partners. And we even had parents who were involved with the collaborative design team. And I would say we changed and did what we did for this program, many instances because of that collaboration and input from our community partners.
And I would just add just the larger context, which is, you know, we've been very angry for years at the low outcomes for ESL students. And we know that not all students are going to get access to dual language, but we wanted to give both ESL and, you know, sort of folks who do maybe speak English access to these programs for all the reasons we're saying. But the state has really begun to prioritize dual language, and so has the district. And they looked at it both as a good education practice, but also an equity issue. And so we're really happy to see the efforts both of APANOs and VNCOs and the Coalition of Communities of Color that have really put forward equity as a key indicator in terms of how programs are created and funded.
Do you want to add, Michael?
Thank you, Joseph. I think one other thing I might add to that is that in the Portland Public Schools, our work right now has been really focused, centered around equity and applying what we call an linguistic equity lens. A racial and linguistic equity lens has really helped us learn what we need to do differently in supporting our emerging bilingual children, as Joseph talked about. And I'd also like to point out that ODE, the Oregon Department of Education, for the first time has put out bilingual dual language grant funds. And this is the first award for Portland Public Schools to support the implementation, the planning, designing, and implementation of the Vietnamese dual language immersion. And that's been a critical support, as well as our partnerships.
Well, this is very exciting, and that's exactly what I was getting at. Traditionally, there has been a lot of resistance for ESL programs, bilingual ed programs, due to a lot of lack of knowledge about the research. So I'm really glad to see that the Portland Public Schools and Oregon Department of Education is being very supportive. Back to you, Kim. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you hope to see with your daughter, because she's in the kindergarten class now, which is the inaugural class. And from what I understand, they're adding a year each year. So next year she'll be in first grade, and they will add, there will be kindergarten and first grade in this program, and the following second, first, and kindergarten, and so on and so forth. What do you hope to see for your daughter going through this program?
I think as a parent, the very first priority is to make sure that she obtains the best education possible. So making sure that the science, the math, the history, all of those things that everybody else is getting, my daughter gets too. So I'm not willing to compromise for that. But if I can get both, if I can get all of those things, all of the standards met, you know, above and beyond, plus get that same information in two languages, then I have a double win. My daughter, you know, will be able to succeed on both fronts. So I think that as she grows, being able to acquire more and more vocabulary, but not at a basic just conversational level, but at a professional or, you know, with a certain expertise towards different areas. I think that that can be a key part to, you know, in the case that she would ever want to practice or travel or work internationally. That's really the difference between, you know, the students who get the traditional education and my daughter, who's lucky enough to be able to be in this program.
Absolutely. I think that's the fundamental difference, not just having the ability to converse maybe with family in the home country, right, but to actually have content,
exactly,
knowledge in both languages is a rare opportunity. It's exciting to see that's happening in Portland. We've been talking about all the successes. I am curious, have you experienced any challenges either with the program or with something that your daughter has seen in the program?
On a personal level, I live really far from Roseway. Well, far in my definition. Mm-hmm. I live in Happy Valley, and the school is in Roseway Heights. So it's been difficult making a decision to travel and basically go out of the way to be in this program. But it's been worth it. So I think that that part has been great. I have to be honest, I haven't really seen anything that I've been disappointed about with the program. In fact, I'm continually surprised. The first day of school, I came in, everything during the school was labeled in both languages. So I'm talking not inside of just her classroom, in the hallways. The hallways labeled Hanlang, both languages, the bathrooms, the multipurpose room. And that really sent a clear message to me that the district not only cares about, you know, this one class, they care on a larger scale. There are bus routes that go out, you know, all the way almost very close to my home that will help transport her there. So it sends a message that this is a real program that the district cares about deeply and that my child is lucky enough to benefit from.
It does. It sends a message that your child is valued and the community is valued,
exactly.
Especially if the mainstream students are getting covert access to the Vietnamese language. That is yeah. Very cool. Is there anything else? Our conversation has to come to a close pretty soon, but is there anything else you all wanted to add to the conversation, Michael and Joseph?
We definitely look forward to folks applying for next year's program, and there is space in the program. There'll be a open process that will open up in the spring. And also, I think, you know, as the program has major events to celebrate its progress, we'd love to invite folks to stay tuned into what's happening and to come to the celebrations that the parents, students, and community pull together.
And I think it's really important to understand this is a long-term commitment. It's not just this year or just 2 years. We actually look at this as a K-12 and really way beyond K-12. This is a lifetime commitment, but one that is incredibly valuable for all kids and especially our emerging bilingual children who speak Vietnamese. And we really encourage, as Joseph said, we really look forward to families visiting our program. Contact Roseway Heights, or you can contact the district office. And we really look forward to a fully implemented K-12 Vietnamese dual language immersion program for the success of our children and the success of our community and all parts of it.
Thank you. Kim, do you have any last remarks you wanted to add?
I would just say, you know, if you are even considering, if you're even just remotely interested, come and take a look, because I did not know what I was getting myself into.
Right,
even
you heard from your
day.
Church.
Exactly. And, you know, initially this was advertised as some kind of replacement for the second language. Instead of Spanish, you could take Vietnamese, but it was advertised as like 1 hour a day. And this is not that. This is something that is just, honestly, I have never seen anything like it. I never imagined it would be available. So if you're even remotely interested, come take a look. I'm happy to talk to any parents that are interested. And, you know, I think that this is something that you'd have to see in order to really know and make a decision.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Michael and Joseph and Kim, for chatting with us and talking about this program here on APA Compass today. And for listeners who want to learn more, contact us at APA Compass on Facebook, and we will get you hooked up with the right people. So thank you all so much for chatting with me.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Again, I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is KBOO Community Radio. And coming up next, we are talking to KBOO's very own Dime Roberts. Dime Roberts is a 2-time Peabody Award-winning radio documentarian, specifically for the piece May May, A Daughter's Song. This feature not only won the Peabody Award in 1989, but it was the first Taiwanese-American story featured on public radio. She joins me by phone. With the audio documentary as the soundtrack, Dime Roberts has created a half-hour film documentary of May May, A Daughter's Song. Mixing live action, animation, and archival footage, May May tells the story of Dime and her mother as they travel to Taiwan together after a long absence. As her mother, Chuyen Roberts' story unfolds, she reveals the abuse she experienced when she was sold into servitude at the age of 2 and her hardship growing up during World War II. Dime, welcome to APA Compass.
Hey, Sarika, how are you?
I'm great. How are you this morning?
Good. I've been listening to the show. The panel was pretty great, so I applaud you for that. That was a great panel.
Thank you very much. Before we get into the film, tell us first about creating the radio documentary. This was an intense personal story, and especially as the first ever Taiwanese-American story for public radio.
Yeah, I didn't really think of it then. You know, I was really exploring my identity for the first time. I had for years told stories about my mom, my biculturalism, and we didn't have the word bicultural at that time or biracial, and people were always, you know, kind of mesmerized and also surprised that I even revealed my identity. And so that was the first time where I thought, well, you know, it's so hard for me to talk about all of my stories that my mom told me, and I wanted to find out more. And it was hard for me to talk about what identity meant to me at that time. So I decided to create a radio piece out of it, got some funding, was able to go through an Oregon Arts Commission fellowship to Taiwan with my mom. And we spent a month there, and I thought it would be sort of a great, you know, mom and daughter piece, and, you know, try to find some harmony between us when we always had such a stormy relationship. And it actually got really bad. We fought like crazy almost the entire time. There were some good moments too, but it was really a painful time. And so what I captured was a lot of sounds of Taiwan, probably about 20 hours of recorded just ambience of Taiwanese opera, of street sounds, marketplace, any kind of sounds, you know, interviews with musicians and artists. And I recorded a children's choir, the Rongxing Children's Choir. And, I just let the tape roll. And for my mom, every time I tried to interview her, she would just yell at me. So I basically thought, well, you know, I know these stories and what she's told me. So I used an actress there, you know, to sort of narrate as Mei Mei or her. And Mei Mei means little sister in Taiwanese, which is a term of endearment. Actually, in Chinese, it's a term of endearment, too, for any little girl. And so, I decided to, you know, put it all together, came back. Took me almost a year to actually, you know, do it. And after that, my mom and I really hadn't, after our trip, we hadn't really talked to each other because we were so mad at each other. And it was really after she heard it, it was the first time that she was able to understand how I felt about us, about our relationship, about, you know, just being this collection of haves that I felt, you know, throughout much of my life. And it was groundbreaking. At that time, radio, you could, you know, mix sound and theater, drama, and, you know, personal narrative. And at that time, most people didn't do that kind of work. So it ended up on NPR, and it was on BBC and CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting and Australian Broadcasting, and it was quite successful, and it's been used as in training classes for audio for especially more experimental, adventurous, artistic audio, and you know, this is going to be the 25th anniversary.
Right, that was my next question.
And I just didn't want the piece to be lost, you know, and I thought, well, you know, let's turn it into a film. And so the whole film is basically a soundtrack for, I mean, the radio piece, my other phone is ringing, the radio piece is a soundtrack for the film, and I haven't changed any of the sound at all.
So how did you collaborate that with adding you have the audio track? How did you add the visual and the other forms of mixed media?
We worked with some I'm working with a really great editor. She's a Korean American filmmaker who's a phenomenal editor too, and so she's been helping me to edit my family photos as well as historical archival photos and film footage that is out there. We've been kind of combing all the archives in Taiwan as well as, you know, the archives here. in America, and we're putting all of that together. And then we also worked with some actors that I've worked with the Theater Diaspora, and through plays that I've stage plays that I've produced in the past, and we shot some live action footage recreating some of the stories my mom told me, and some of the stories that I tell in about my mom and me in Taiwan, in a studio. And we shot it at Mount Hood Community College's Integrated Media Program studio. And then I also hired a painter. Her name is Willow Zhang, and she does wonderful Chinese brush paintings. And so she created about 11 different pieces of artwork that we're using in the film that we're trying to give more of a 3D effect, animation effect to. And, you know, that's pretty much it, you know. It's a mixing of genres. But I think that because the piece, the radio
that
piece
must have
so
been
what I wanted to do with is to experiment with the film.
Well, that must have been a challenge, being somebody who's been steeped in working with audio for a number of years. To now
well,
add
actually,
this other component.
You know, I was one of the first producers to start doing visuals with flash animation and slideshows back in 2000. And I remember, and then making short movies with my radio pieces. And so I have been doing this for quite a while. I remember in 2000 when I was doing visual work with the audio work, I had radio producers tell me, why are you doing that? We're supposed to be doing radio. You're not supposed to show photos. You're not supposed to do slideshows. You're not supposed to animate, you know, what you have, what you've recorded meticulously on sound. And I said, well, you know what? We're moving towards a different multimedia universe. And so I have been doing multimedia work for quite a long time. It is challenging. You are right about that. This is the longest film that I've ever made. It's most of the films that I've made have been real short. This one is going to be at least 30 minutes. So the whole piece is about 26, but then we're sort of adding some quiet moments in it too. So it'll be at least 30 minutes, probably a little bit more. And that is a long amount because, you know, it moves. You know, you don't just linger. It's not a slideshow by any means. So I hope people will turn out for it on
right.
May 21st at
well,
8 p.m.
Right. There's the screening that is at, as you just mentioned, at Clinton Street Theater at 8 p.m. on November 21st for our listeners. But you have a screening that's happening today. You're about to leave for it, in fact.
Oh, that's right. I'm getting ready to go to Eugene for the Eugene International Film Festival. And I had previously entered a five-minute short version of May May. And, you know, they accepted it a couple months ago, but I said, well, you know, we're nearing production. Would you like a longer version? So we created the first 10 minutes of the film to screen and to debut today at 5 p.m. at the Valley River Center Regal Cinemas. If anybody in Eugene is listening, that would be great to see you there.
Great. And again, to remind our listeners, your film in its entirety will be screened at the Clinton Street Theater November 21st at 8 p.m. Our listeners, you definitely don't want to miss that. I was curious, how does it feel to use these different forms of media to represent what you experienced 25 years ago and you and your mother? How does that feel? What is that experience?
It is very difficult personally, you know. It was the hardest radio piece that I've ever created, you know, and it was one of my first documentaries. And at that time, you know, I was pretty naive, thinking I could put all everything personal into the pot and not have it affect me. It did affect me. For the longest time, I couldn't even listen, you know, to the piece. If people asked me to play it, I would just play, you know, I would start the piece and then walk out of the room, because for a long time it was difficult to hear it without bursting into tears. Now, my mom has been gone for about 12 years now, and I feel like in some ways it is a tribute to her, even though it is very difficult and it's very honest. It's been called brutally honest about a mother-daughter relationship. In many ways, it's still a tribute to her. So I've been combing through all these photographs that I didn't realize that I had, and now, you know, in digitizing them. And I don't know, it, you know, at times I remove myself, as I wear my director-producer hat, I can remove myself, you know, a little bit personally. But there are times when I listen and I watch and I still cry, you know. And it isn't that it's always sad. It's more the sense of the honesty of it, about how difficult it is for mothers and daughters, or fathers and sons, you know, parent and child, to really bridge what divides us. You know, and in every parent-child relationship, there's something, you know, that is hard to overcome. And that's what is at the heart of the piece. And so when I think about that, and I think about all the times we didn't talk to each other because we were mad, and I go, what wasted years those were, you know? And so yeah, it does move me emotionally quite often. And I don't know, you know, if other people will be affected by it as I do. I hope that they will be to a certain extent. And it'll be great to see it in front of an audience today, to see, you know, how it connects to people. I don't want it to be just my story. I try to universalize everything that I do. And I try to think about, you know, how other people can relate to, you know, material, especially if it's autobiographical or personal. And I hope that it touches, but it has been difficult, you know, going through the breath. What has been interesting too is to have actors sort of reenact these stories and playing my mom, you know, or you know, at different ages, and you know, that's been interesting too, to see that, because it's a, you know, it's a different picture than what I have, but it's representational, and I hope that it connects to the audience.
Absolutely.
And kind of fun too, Sarika, you know?
Absolutely.
It feels like a new chapter in my career, if you will, and I really love that part of it. I love that creating something new, and it's been a challenge, and we're
definitely
still working on it. And you know, we've got most of it done, but we still have a couple weeks before the big showing. So if people want to track the progress, we're building our website, and we have it up. It's meimeiproject.org, and it's meimeiproject.org if people want to check it out.
Well, Dimae Roberts, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me and for sharing these intense stories here with us at APA Compass.
Well, thank you, Sarika, and kudos to you for this show. I think it's a real blessing to the community, so I want to encourage you and the other producers to keep going with it, because it's really an important show to have.
Thank you so much. That's Dimae Roberts, radio documentarian, filmmaker, and host of KBOO's arts program, Stage and Studio. You can track her her film at meimeiproject.org, meimeiproject.org. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for listening to APA Compass, the Pacific Northwest's only Asian Pacific American public affairs radio program. Thanks to today's guests, Kim Lee, Michael Bacon, Joseph Santos Lyons, Asa Jackson, Deepa Iyer, and Dimae Roberts. Thanks to our engineer, Sam Parrish. APA Compass airs at 9 a.m. the first Friday of every month and is collectively produced by Liz Rogers, Kushlani DeSouza, Luann Elgoso, Pamela Santos, and myself, Sarika Mehta. You can download segments of this and other shows at our website, apacompass.wordpress.com. If you have a story idea or want to pitch an Angry APA Minute, leave us a message on our Facebook page, APA Compass Radio, or tweet us at APA Compass. This is APA Compass. Thanks for listening. Aww.